Hello, everybody. For those that don't know, my name is Mike Moe, and welcome to Channel 3. This is episode 2 of our ongoing GSV Virtual Summit series. If you were looking for the pre-K channel, that's Channel 1. If you were looking for the K-12 channel, that's Channel 2. If you want to get there, you can go into chat, and you can get the links to be directed to where you'd like to be. If you're looking for Tiger King, you're out of luck, but let me tell you that. Also, I just wanted to let you know, I wasn't originally supposed to host Channel 3. That was our partner, Deborah Quazzo. As some of you may have heard, she had an accident and broke her jaw. She had that fighting another venture capitalist the other day. Not what happened. She had a freak out. And on the counter in her kitchen, but she has her jaw wired shut for the next couple of weeks. So I'm pinch hitting for her. Before I turn over the first panel to Rob Hutter, I also want to remind you at the end of the second panel, which I'll be hosting on Channel 1, we have Mark Brackett, Yale professor, who's going to be doing a session on coping with COVID. So we're very fortunate to have that. So with no further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the program over to Rob Hutter, our moderator. Rob is the founder of Learn Capital. He's an extraordinary entrepreneur, founded a number of businesses. Learn Capital is a leading investor in the education technology space. We're great admirers of Rob and Learn. Rob is, they've invested in companies like VIP Kid, PhotoMath, Coursera, Andela, and besides being a great investor, Rob's a great guy. And so I'll let Rob moderate the people here, and I'll be on after the session's over. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike, and really appreciate that kind intro. It makes me want to say, believe, you know, half of what you see and none of what you hear as it relates to myself, for sure. But it's a privilege to be here. Thank you for making this happen during this extraordinary time. And obviously our thoughts go out to Deborah. I know the jaw issue is especially difficult because of you know, her communication intensity. But I know that we'll be getting a lot of texts and emails from her, and I hear that she's doing really well. So the show will go on. And certainly very excited to be here for this forum. So why don't we jump in and bring some context to this panel, which is one that I'm particularly excited to do. You know, people used to ask me frequently, what was the technology in ed tech? And, you know, honestly, going back 5-7 years ago, reality was ed tech was primarily bringing approaches that were working in other segments. And essentially deploying it for the purposes of education, learning, and pedagogy. But there wasn't a tremendous amount of what we would call deep tech in the space. And that's changed radically in the last 3 years. And it's tremendous to have this group of panelists here today, all of whom represent companies that are bringing very complex and very productivity forward technologies into the learning arena. And without further ado, I want to go ahead and introduce each one of our panelists. And if you all will, you know, please do a sort of a 30-second lightning intro to yourself and your company, and talk a little about the key technology, the emerging technology that you showcase. So maybe I'll start. I'm just looking here across the view screen. Emily, let's start with you.
Awesome. Welcome. Wonderful to be here. Thanks so much, Rob. I'm Emily. I lead the data team at Coursera across data engineering, data science, machine learning. At a high level, Coursera is a three-sided platform for education. And we bring together on the demand side more than 50 million global learners and over 2,300 companies who come to us to upskill their talent. And on the supply side, we connect them with content and credentials from about 170 university and 20 industry partners, so ranging from Stanford to Yale to Google, and teaching everything from courses to degrees. My team in particular is responsible for end-to-end creating value from data. As I think about sort of what is cutting edge or emerging technology, the most relevant is the machine learning work, in particular focused on three use cases. One is considering the diversity of our users and of our content, really robustly matching folks with the right content to reach their career goals, given where they are today. The second is to support them with high quality learning experiences at low cost. So how can we have fully automated interventions and support systems, as well as human in the loop systems that use machine learning to accelerate instruction? And then third, how can we build bottoms-up skills-based credentials to ensure folks are rewarded for what they know based on the rich assessment data that's generated on the platform, really tying those skill signals to careers?
Yeah, tremendous. Very, very, very helpful. Thank you, Emily. Welcome. Let me jump to actually, I see, again, I'm looking for my view screen, which may be different for people watching, but I see Damir. Damir, welcome in from Croatia. Hello. Please talk to us about Photomath.
Hello, everybody. My name is Damir. I'm founder, co-founder and CEO of Photomath. Photomath is probably the most popular and one of the most popular education apps globally. Primary use case is you take a picture of a math problem, so we will understand what it is using AI and some more classical computer programming approaches. So we will recognize what you are looking at or what your phone is looking at. We'll try to understand what it is and show you step-by-step explanation how to solve this problem. More or less, this is it. More than $150 million in the last several years. Using AI technology, mostly in recognition part, so to understand what user is looking at or what they need help with. And focused on generating content by software. So full stack there from recognition to providing automatically generated content.
Yeah, tremendous. Awesome. Well, welcome in here. Good seeing you, sir. Let me shift on to Valerie. Valerie, hello, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having me here. Valerie Schweiner, I'm the Chief Product Officer at Turnitin. And while many people know Turnitin, they generally know us for our plagiarism prevention business, which really isn't a particularly emerging technology. But what we have been involved with over the last several years is we have a team of about 20 ML and AI scientists who are focused on creating efficiencies in the end-to-end assessment process, whether that assessment is an assignment, a quiz, a test, or an essay, using two major sets of technologies in artificial intelligence to make that process more efficient. The first is natural language processing to provide feedback to the student directly, as well as insights to the instructor who may be assessing that text work. The second is image recognition and grouping. This came to us through our acquisition of a technology out of Berkeley called Gradescope. Gradescope has a assessment delivery platform that works with either digital or paperwork that's scanned in to group student answers to make the grading and feedback process more efficient for instructors. And I think one of the key kind of differentiators for Turnitin in the way that we're using AI is it's very much about facilitating the relationship that still exists between the instructor and the student rather than replacing it. It's about making that a more efficient thing that still allows the instructor to be really deeply involved in the pedagogy.
Hmm. That's well stated. And that concept of relationship between versus replacement is something I'd love to get back to. Great to see you here, Valerie, and welcome. Moving down, I see Mike Olson. Mike, good morning. Welcome to the panel.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me. Mike Olson, CEO of Proctorio. Normally, I have a barber, so I don't look like a I apologize for my bare appearance. Proctorio, what we did 7 years ago was say that testing centers and what at the time was remote proctoring wouldn't scale. Today, most of the people in the space actually still use the same scale technology that they use, and that's using call centers and people. And what we saw in the last several weeks is every university needing to go online to administer safe exams without testing centers. And all the competition using call centers had them shut down from underneath them. So we had predicted sort of a shift 7 years ago. We kind of figured this would happen over the next 10 years. And basically in the last 10 days, we've seen the last 10 years of jump. What we do is secure exams so they can be taken from the comfort of their home or given the current situation, virus-free. And those exams are secure, they're monitored, and they're analyzed by computers who can make the final decision and pass that information to the university and say, these assessments were taken with the same integrity as a testing center or as if they took them in your classroom.
No, it's tremendous, Mike. Well, this idea that what happened in the last couple of weeks, you know, now accelerates us by years is clearly a topic that we want to spend more energy on. And Mike, mention your company's name. Some people have been asking.
Oh, yes, sir. Proctorio.
Proctorio. Yeah. Yeah. So fantastic. I'm looking forward to circling back on that. Our final panelist, Ulrich, is joining. Ulrich, good morning. Hello.
Hey. I'm Ulrich Christensen. I'm the CEO of Area 9. I'm originally a physician by training, and I usually don't use this room, but we have a lot of people in the house these days. We have a couple of families living together. I've been here for 3 weeks. So this is actually my background, literally, it's medicine. I'm the CEO of Area 9, which is a company that for many years has been known to be in the adaptive learning and the higher end of the e-learning space, where highly curated content. We built the platforms that McGraw-Hill is pretty famous for, LearnSmart, SmartBook, and Connect, only the adaptive parts of Connect though. And have built, on my watch, it was about 1,400 curricula on it, so full one semester, two semester curricula. And since then, I think they've built 700 more. Lyceum is our fourth generation platform, which sets itself apart in a number of ways. We're quite far into it now, have the Danish state as our main investor. And we work in everything from K-12 through professional education. A large part of the hypothesis is we really work a lot with companies and have signed a couple of hundred corporate clients, large-scale corporate clients. So we work with high-impact learning, the learning that really needs to work. And ironically, like with Mike's company, the last 10 days, a large part of the world has realized that learning actually needs to work when it's happening remotely. So we've released a number of products, and among other things, like we've certified I think about 65,000 laboratory professionals to handle COVID-19 and are now training people on ventilation skills. But we work across everything. So medicine is just like a pet project of ours.
Wow.
Right now, pretty good, though.
A very important pet project, though, and tremendous that Area 9 has been able to really help with the solution. Ulrich, welcome in this morning as well. So as we turn to some topics to kind of really dive into, you know, what, just one real kind of stage setting point that many of our panelists have already kind of raised, which is we're kind of living in the future, and it's a future that we have been hoping and planning for, but in many cases, it's really being accelerated. And I think the most obvious point is that we have over a billion students currently at home being homeschooled. In most of the world, we're all doing this remote work. And learning is occurring in the same context. And we look at the world from Learn Capital, you know, one of the simplest ways to talk about what's happening in our space is the digitization of learning is real. You know, we jump from 1% digital penetration to 3% in about 10 years. Sounds great. You know, when you compare it to entertainment and media, you might see numbers in the 50% or higher. I think a good comparison is e-commerce. We use this frequently. E-commerce's penetration of retail, right? And this is also a pre-COVID number. Is approximately 15 to 20%. We're going to see that shift significantly as we return to normal and plan a new kind of hybrid normal life. E-learning, unlike e-commerce, depends on far fewer things. We don't need logistics. We don't need warehouses. We don't need drones dropping packages on people's homes. We can do a lot of what we need to do with learning with the technologies that all of you are currently producing. And so when we think about what the future holds, we were predicting 3 to 9%. Now the real question is it 3 to 30%? Is it 3 to 40%? And it's a $6 trillion space. So this is an extraordinary acceleration in terms of effectively the value that's moving through the pipes that we're all involved in. So let me ask a question that I hope we'll get some intriguing perspectives on the table. all of you are producing really exciting technologies that have wide user bases and are playing a very important role in the solution generally, and have been for years now. You know, in normal times, what I'd like to understand, and we'll set this up, we'll talk about now and the future, but in normal times, what do you think were effectively the headwinds that you were facing despite great adoption? What was still holding back from getting to ubiquity in each of your different cases? Pre-COVID effectively, what did you think still needed to change? Let me start with Tamir. What do you think were the holdbacks to everybody in the planet using PhotoMath up till now? Sorry to put you on the spot, my friend.
Yeah, it's no problem. So reaction that we are getting from people when they're using PhotoMath is, or for parents or from teachers, is some will say, you know, oh, I wouldn't allow my kids to use it. But everybody will say, I wish I had this in high school, you know? So there is this gap between what they wanted and what they expect their kids to use. And our students and our users understand the value. But I'm not sure that every like teacher or parent understands the value. And this is sometimes we need to explain it. Sometimes they will be, as I said, like they will have different criteria for what they would like, or and what their kids would actually like or want to use. So this was one question, and then we heard questions, of course, like always, like is this a cheating tool? Or actually, is it a learning tool? And actually, it looks like it is a learning tool now. You know, when they really need it a lot, and when you have nobody to help you with something, it is actually becoming really a learning tool, and they understand it is becoming a learning tool. So these are these, and we were actually in this. Now we were pioneers in this space. And it is like, and now we can see like this value is like very obvious, and it wasn't, but it is becoming very, very obvious, and we hope it will continue to be very obvious for users. So yeah, this is what we can understand is happening here.
Understood. That's very helpful as a context. Valerie, let's talk about Turnitin for a second. What was normal times like for you guys?
I mean, portions of our technology are broadly adopted, right? We have 80-90% market share in certain places.
Indeed.
Other portions far less so. And I think, I mean, honestly, the barrier, if you will, is just inertia. I look at someone like the College Board with the AP exams. College Board AP exams have been delivered in proctored environments with physical proctors on a piece of paper and then shipped in cardboard boxes around the world for people to sit around banquet tables and grade with rubrics on whiteboards. That's how that process takes place. And it's taken place that way for years. And the grading process is on paper and manual, the delivery of the assessment is on paper and manual, the proctored process is, you know, with a physical human in a physical room. And all of a sudden, guess what? The AP exams are fully online and digital this year because they have to be. And I don't know that anything other than that was going to make that change happen, given that we're in 2020 and the plan was still to deliver them on paper and physical rooms. So I think, you know, it was just a forcing function. And before that, that forcing function wasn't there.
Right. Well, it's tremendous. Well, for anyone, you know, thinking about AP tests going all digital overnight, it's huge. And that very much makes it vivid, I think, for any of us. Tremendous, yeah. Well, speaking of proctoring, maybe I could turn to Mike. Mike, you spoke earlier about how the radical change was so obvious in a couple of weeks because of moving from call centers to remote. I mean, maybe add a little more texture to that, if you will. And what were that fundamentally the type of market forces you were up against prior to COVID?
Well, prior to COVID, you have the concept of testing centers, the brick and mortar building,
right?
And the companies that control that industry, it's about a $900 million a year revenue sort of industry. You got Pearson VUE, Prometric, and their physical testing centers, and they basically sell fear. They sell fear. They sell these wigs with transmitters in them and things like that, and they scare all these institutions into, you have to use a testing center, you have to use a testing center. In higher ed, that has kind of shifted away. Instead, you have the existing companies that sell the same fear, but they do it with the remote proctor. You have to have a human there. There has to be a human, someone in some call center watching somebody through the webcam while they take their exam in their bedroom. And, you know, that was sort of in higher ed, the thing we were up against. And now that it's not possible for them to do it, it's like Valerie said, they're forced to actually adopt our technology. And they're doing it tremendously. Final exam period is starting. This time last year, we would maybe do 30,000 online exams a day. Yesterday, we did 170,000 online exams. A bulk of that is actually coming out of Europe. Europe didn't have, they love pencil and paper. Pencil and paper, exams in the classroom, maybe testing centers. And now they're being forced completely online and digital because it's actually really bad. I mean, we onboarded like 13 universities in Italy in the last 2 weeks. The situation has just forced them to totally change the way they do things. And, you know, we were set up for this to begin with, obviously not in anticipation of this, but, you know, we provide the solution that does work given the current circumstances.
That's tremendous. And in a moment today when theoretically people at home could maybe be mobilized into armies of remote, surveillors, for lack of a better term, it turns out that your solution provides, it's just the ability to scale it without having to train those individuals, I'm assuming is a huge.
Yeah, without having to train it. And I know that those companies are trying to move that way. I would caution anyone doing that. We've obviously been in a hiring spree because we need people, engineers. We're pushing products 6 months ahead of schedule, right? Where we're pushing things as quick as possible. And it takes me 2 weeks to get a background check right now because of COVID. Right. So any of these sort of adding people working from home, I caution anyone moving to that model, especially with webcams and people watching people in their bedrooms and things like that.
Right, right. Touché. Well, speak about being prepared for this moment, Mike. That's tremendous color. Let me turn to Ulrich, for a minute. Ulrich, talk a little bit about how life was for you right prior to this and what were some of the things you were hoping would change in your direction.
Yeah, so I think that higher ed was pretty far down our road already. It's table stakes now to work with Adaptive and high impact, and grades and performance was really driving it. But what was interesting was in the corporate market, you could say that the fuel for the fire was there. But we were like, what this has really done is it has put a match to it. Because the underlying trends where we've seen McKinsey and Accenture and Cognizant and all the other big ones, like talking about the change, the future change of work, like how would work in the future change? How would human talent change? All these things were there. So I think it was begun like 10 years ago, it was neither urgent nor important. Today it was important, or right before this, it was important, but not urgent. Right. And now suddenly in a nutshell, it's become super, super urgent to solve this. And I think it's a transition. Like we're working a pipeline of well over 1,000 companies, where we're sometimes looking at it being like, we're in complete agreement that it's the right direction. They know this is where they need to be 3 to 4 years from now. And during this, we've closed deals with large pharma companies that are doing continuous medical education, 3 weeks from first introduction to signature on the paper. Our lead time just 3 months ago, we were looking at somewhere in the 6 to 36 months pipeline cycles. I think that it's the urgency that is different. And I think that was reflected particularly in terms of how do you bring high quality learning to market? So when we launched the COVID-19 course that is approved by two of the largest organizations in the world, the manuscript was made in 24 hours by a doctor who was quarantined in Italy, or the head of one of the infectious departments, 48 hours for learning engineering, and 72 hours for approval by two major institutions. Which is the fastest it's ever been done with these kind of approvals. and we're certifying one person a minute, right? If you're in the free market, and for many of you, we will have tried this before, but in healthcare, it's unheard of.
Incredible. Wow, incredible. Well, again, it speaks volumes as well to your ability to deploy your solution to folks on the front lines in healthcare.
Broke the servers 14 times. It was on a separate server. It broke it 14 times the first weekend. So.
Wow, incredible. And I noticed that the COVID certification is available now. I think in some of these certifications are available obviously for free, you know, through sponsors and your own generosity, which is tremendous. So folks,
we're paying for it.
Yeah, well, okay.
This is our contribution back.
100. And you can, and folks can find that at the Area 9 website. That's tremendous work. Let me talk to Emily. So Emily from Coursera. We've seen Coursera in the news quite a bit recently during this time frame. Talk a little bit about, perhaps if you could, what it was like prior to this, you know, as this became, you know, our new normal.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think prior to this, there definitely has been somewhat broad adoption of the Coursera platform. But when you talk about headwinds, I think of two related headwinds in particular. One is on the learner side. So when learners go out looking for education, they're really looking for two things. One is the development of human capital or skills, right? They want to learn things. And the second is the credential. So the ability to signal those skills in the labor market so they can be rewarded for what they know. I think, you know, the primary blocker to 10x, 100x adoption of online solutions like Coursera or others is some skepticism in some communities about the value of the credential. In traditional education, you know, it's a little bit of a catch-22 because in traditional education, a lot of the value of the credential actually comes from the selectivity of entry into the institution, which is like directly at odds with our mission, which is to provide universal access to, you know, life-transforming learning and credentials. So everyone should be able to get it. But if there's not that selectivity up front, then how do we ensure that there's value to the credential? And our approach is to develop bottoms-up skills-based signals, but there is some inertia in the labor market. It takes time for those to be recognized. And in tandem, we're also leaning in on traditional credentials like degrees. I think the second primary headwind outside of the fact that it takes time to build up trust and credentials is just on the university side. So again, some of the inertia that Valerie mentioned, willingness of universities to put more content online. I was talking yesterday to a provost of one of the US's best historically Black colleges. The institution has 10,000 students. They're not yet a Coursera partner. And he said, look, right now of my course catalog, about 2% is taught online. I would like 35% of that to be taught online by the fall. You know, historically, I would have said, hey, 4% by the fall, move gradually, but now is really the moment. We need it for our on-campus students. And so I expect that once institutions and in particular faculty have experience teaching online for their existing students, it'll be easier to expand that to new demographics of students globally in an online context.
100%. And Coursera is bringing a variety. You talked about the trust and credentials taking time. Coursera is bringing a variety of credentials above and beyond what would normally be seen as either degrees or certificates. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So our perspective is for some folks at some points in their life, they absolutely need full diploma bearing degrees. So we have about 14 degrees live on the platform. They range from, you know, bachelor's in computer science to a master's like an MBA or a master's in public health. But not everybody needs a degree at all points in their life. Some folks need a professional certificate or even a gateway certificate. They don't yet have a college degree, but they need something that makes them job ready, for example, to be a Google IT support specialist. At other points, folks just need to be able to signal that they have some incremental skills, and a course certificate or a specialization certificate is sufficient. And so we're really seeking to meet the needs of a variety of different types of learners at different points of their life with a range of credentials.
Yeah, very, very helpful. Very, very helpful. We are starting to get some Q&A. So folks, feel free to ask in the Q&A bubble, the modal there on Zoom. And we're going to turn to Q&A from folks in just a second. I have one quick question. If folks can respond relatively quickly on this. This is a question I think a lot of people are interested in is, you know, here in particular, companies are all experiencing various forms of acceleration during COVID. Obviously, in some cases, radical. Talk a little bit, brief, if you will, about how you manage your organization when everyone is basically home quarantined and you have to respond to sales inbounds, trying to close contracts and so forth. So maybe provide a little texture on that. Maybe I'll jump to Mike first. Mike, you talked about how rapid you've been, you know, signing up and deploying.
Yeah. So it was actually a nightmare. We have a very strict work from home culture, anti work from home. Not that I'm not hip enough to support it, but we most people within our organization have access to certain sensitive information, things like that. There's source code for engineers and quality assurance. We say, look, you want to be at home, you just take the day off, right? No vacation sort of hour tracking. Given that, it was a complete culture shift. No one in our organization had ever worked from home before. And so we had to deploy all sorts of security protocols, deploy equipment, put in a system of monitoring people. I mean, we're checking in on people to make sure they're not sick and they have the things that they need and access to. So there was a huge shift there. And at the same time, we were receiving, we have a lead form on our site. It usually gets maybe 20, 30 leads a month. In the last 3 weeks, we've got 1,900. So going through qualifying those, everything, every playbook we had is out the window. We had to completely rewrite everything, new processes for going through that. It's been a nightmare. I think most things have stabilized. As far as our customers, I think, you know, they didn't really notice it. It was chaos inside the company. Scaling-wise, we're deploying tons and tons of resources, like I said, in Europe. We had to open 3 new data centers out there just to support the load. We never saw the sort of demand we're seeing in Europe. US, we were, you know, final exam period, we were ready for this. It's just now every day is final exam period. So that's been sort of our struggle. It was people trying to keep people positive too, because I mean, everyone is operating, you know, unfortunately, at like 14, 16 hour days. And then they're forced, right? So we have a customer experience team. They're forced by the customers to be on and fill their calendars and things like that. So it's not like I'm there with the whip cracking it. They're being forced by the customers that they're trying to support.
Understood. There's a famous song from the band called The Smiths, or I think it was Morrissey, part of my lack of pop knowledge, called Every Day Is Like Sunday. I think in COVID, people are saying every day is like Monday, right? There's no break. We're working all the time. One of the many things we'll be happy to exit from when COVID moves back. Maybe Ulrich, talk a little bit about how things are working with Area 9 as you go.
So for us, it was the opposite of Mike. We were almost 100% virtual. Many of our programmers we've never met. They've been on the payroll for over 15 years and we've never seen them. And I think about half of our programmers have never been called to a scheduled meeting. So we were, it was super easy for us. I actually think I'm more productive because I'm not traveling. Nobody blames me for not being on a plane.
Yes. Yes. Understood. So in that case, you said the culture was ready to move and understood.
And it was matured over 20 years. So yes. we know how to not waste time on chat rooms.
Yes.
Like to be productive there.
Super helpful. Valerie, talk a little bit about turning in.
Sure. I'd say we were much closer to Ulrich in that we have a very strong work from home culture. We're a very distributed organization in 9 countries. And so the need to collaborate virtually has always been a part of Turnitin. I think we have had to scale systems more in the way that Mike was talking about around customer demand. So, you know, we were holding webinars about how to use Gradescope for assessment. And where we might normally get 400 or 500, you know, we had 1,600 people last week at a Latin American webinar about how to run an online assessment. So when you have that, you don't just need one or two people responding to the questions like we have today, right? Like you need dozens of people ready to just like interact in a webinar with 1,600 people. And so there's been adjustments like that. But in general, I think we found the technology easy. We found the cultural aspects easy. Honestly, the hardest thing for our team is we do have a lot of really young families is the children, right? Like the small children running around in the background when you're trying to give a presentation on a, you know. So that's really, and we can't control that, right? That's not part of it. So.
Well, they're welcome, you know. You know, said, right? It's a new normal, right? We, you know, children will enter this panel possibly. That's very helpful, Valerie. You know, Emily or Demir, anything particularly noteworthy on this topic of culture? How do you manage during time?
Yeah, so I'd say in the cases of products or business lines that were already up and running, we went to remote work relatively effectively. People are invigorated by the opportunity to provide our service to more folks. We're seeing on the order of 8x increases in registrations and enrollments in, you know, our core courses and specializations. And that's exciting and motivating, and those teams already know how to work together. So working together remotely is relatively streamlined. There are sort of two pressure points in those existing businesses. One is on the infrastructure. So keeping the site up, making sure the data systems all work at scale, you know, our recommendation system actually like can't accommodate the scale of net new users coming in real time. So how do we refactor and how do we do that on the fly? And the second is services. So, you know, lots of learners reach out for support, especially new learners to our platform need additional support. Some of our outsourcing vendors were actually closed down. Not all of those people could work remotely because not all had connectivity at home, for example, in Guatemala. And so we've had to work across data science and engineering with the services team to figure out how we can automate more of that support for learners. It's a project we should have done a while ago, but now is a forcing function. I would say where it's been most challenging is in net new products or businesses. So there's a relatively new use case for Coursera. We launched it last fall called Coursera for Campus. It's helping colleges and universities go online, in particular by providing the Coursera catalog to on-campus students. And you know, when we launched it in the fall, there was healthy growth, but over the last month, we've launched almost 4,000 programs requested by colleges and universities who need to go online urgently, and more than 4 million student licenses within those programs have been administered. And because it's a relatively new use case, we're still figuring out those workflows, and those cross-functional teams are new. And so, for example, my team realized that we could use natural language processing to map on-campus catalogs to content available on Coursera and use that to help those schools move online faster with existing content. But then how do you deploy that? How does that become part of the sales cycle, the customer success cycle, the support cycle when these teams and these initiatives haven't worked together as closely? So right. I think that's, it's just, it's good growing pains, but it's a little bit of growing pain.
Understood. Yes. Huge. Net new products. That's a really good insight, are harder to do in this context. Demir, anything to add here before we go to our lightning round?
It is just like, this is actually speeding up our, we are preparing a content contributor network that is actually online. Right. So it is actually speeding up these processes. We were infrastructure-wise, we were actually ready because most of our processing is done on device, and this was a decision we made a long time ago. So we can scale without almost any issues. And culture, it is not easy, but we are also more or less we were ready to do it. There are some challenges, but for us, it was actually quite easy.
Yes,
I don't know. It's still okay. So.
Yeah, you guys are also managing multiple offices around the world as well. Yeah, cool. So listen, I want to do a lightning round. Then I want to take some questions, or at least consolidate some of the questions we have. A couple minutes left. So lightning round is basically this. So we've talked about the acceleration that's clearly happening as folks are forced to effectively suddenly be all virtual, all remote learning. So the question is, 10-year out future to the 1-year out future, or is it the 5-year out future? What do you think, how many years do you think we've gained through this crazy unprecedented experience in terms of online learning? Let me start with Ulrich. How many years? 10 years, 5 years, what's your view?
5 years. And five I years. Think it's because we were close, and that's looking at the corporate education space, because I think we were relatively close to the tipping point already. But I think it's in that scale.
Understood, 5 years, that's a good answer. Valerie, what do you think?
I think it varies by sector. I look at it and I think of, for our market, prestige institutions that always relegated online learning to sort of those people, I think it's 10 years for them, because all of a sudden they can no longer relegate online learning to some alley. For, you know, midline universities that have been exploring online but aren't really sophisticated at it, maybe 5 years. And obviously for the SNHU and Western Governors of the world, they were already there. They're actually just raking in, you know, the joy of the fact that their model has been validated in a lot of ways.
Right, 100%. Makes a lot of sense. So it's different depending on the segment, the sub-segment, actually, in this case. Emily, what do you think? How many years have we gained?
I think it's up to the several hundred people on this call. I think by default, we will have gained 5 years. And I think if we respond effectively, if we deeply understand the new and emerging needs, and if we build products and services to meet those needs in the online context, then we could easily make it 10 or 15. But it's up to us. And I'd encourage us not to just stay the course with our existing roadmaps, but really think about, you know, how can we step up to meet this new demand?
Great. Mike, do you want to add to this?
No, I agree with everyone. The only other thing, like Valerie said, that depends on the segment. I would say region as well.
Okay,
good point. There are parts of, I think, Africa we've never even been talking to that we're now engaged with, moving things online. So, and like I said, Europe, huge for us. We've got two offices in Europe. And as it turns out, I mean, there's with GDPR, they can only contract with an organization that's actually in Europe.
Right.
A lot of what we do, privacy related, privacy focused. So it was a good thing we had those entities set up there, because that's the only way we can contract and administer exams. Yeah. Otherwise, if we were just a US company, it wouldn't happen. So
that's an interesting point. Very interesting point. Very interesting texture. Demir, how many years do you think we've gained on this? 3, 5, 10 more?
How difficult to say. For us, it wasn't really. Our students are already there. The question is, are parents and teachers?
Yes.
So I think like students are already there. They want it. They want to use it. And for parents and teachers, we think this will actually accelerate things. Difficult to say how.
God, how many years, right?
Understood.
Well, to your point earlier, with everyone out home and needing help on all these worksheets they've been given, you've seen that acceleration.
Yeah, and there is anecdotal evidence that we can see parents and they're saying, okay, like Photomat is now really helping.
Yeah.
A lot. And they're like, so it's there is anecdotal evidence. Of course, we see clear usage growth, like significant. So in affected countries, Italy, for example, is like also number one for us in terms of growth.
And which is really interesting in its own right, and perhaps not surprising, but very interesting. So I want to turn to Q&A, and obviously this has been very provocative discussion. So we're going to have a couple of minutes. Obviously wish we'd have more. So in this case, I'm going to go through, there's probably one or two questions that seem to be thematically connected among folks that have contributed to the Q&A modal. And one of them is really this question of, touched a little bit on it through Mike and Emily's points and Valerie's points as well, is this idea of, you know, there's a lot of inequality out there. Access to broadband, access to laptops. We've seen that some of the largest districts in America have literally decided not to do remote learning because there's social equity issues involved. And they can't guarantee quality across all different income brackets. What do you think is, tell me your point of view about that facet of this, that there's inequality that we're suddenly dealing with as we push from 0 to 100% remote. Who would like to jump in on this one?
Well, I think the answer is not to not do online learning, but is to figure out how to mitigate the inequality, right? Whether that's, we've seen districts here locally via donations move to one-to-one overnight, like get devices out to all the students. Now there's still access and broadband to deal with, but solving some of those basic inequity challenges is, you know, part of what I'm excited about, the fact that those things are going to get advanced quickly because they have to be. And then I think, yeah, I mean, I'll just leave it at that and let other people comment. But I believe that we will do the right thing now because we have to. And I think it's a great opportunity for us as a nation.
Mm-hmm. Well put.
This is flipping the question on its head a little bit, but I think we're also going to see a dramatic expansion, unfortunately, in inequalities in the labor market. And we're already seeing that, right? We all are in tech and there's increased demand for our products. And by and large, our employees are able to work remotely. And that's not true for service workers. And that's not true for people in the bottom half of the income distribution. And so I think part of our responsibility also is to figure out how we can develop the right and deploy the right educational solutions for folks who are soon to be unemployed, and thinking about not just reaching them through their universities or through their high schools, but also potentially through governments as sort of broad-based workforce development programs is going to be something that the edtech space needs to think about increasingly urgently.
That's well put for edtech to turn around and try to solve that problem effectively, right? Okay.
And I think that if you look at the corporate space, I think it's easy to get confused because we have our kids running around at home and only think that education is K-12. I think one of the things we've seen the last few weeks is that it's also part of the solution three quarters of the laboratory professionals we've trained have been in India and the Philippines, in areas where they normally don't have access to education and where they will have a substantial impact. And we're expecting to train tens of thousands of people who would otherwise not have a chance to learn how to operate a ventilator. So I think that some of the classic reach discussions about e-learning will suddenly, as long as we stay committed to stop selling snake oil, as has been one of the criticisms of our industry, that if we can solve the reliability issue that Emily also brought up, that in the past, can you really trust that when we do this, it is at par or better with what we've otherwise been doing? And I think if we solve that problem, I think we can counteract some of that inequality, particularly when we look outside K-12.
Right. Very, very helpful. Well, I wish we could have this conversation continue for the rest of the day. There's a tremendous amount of interest and intensity among the work you're doing, among the panelists, among the questions that we're getting. But unfortunately, all good things must come to an end. We're being told the next session is about to start. So I want to thank our panelists and welcome in Mr. Michael Moe back to the stage. Thank you all for your contributions this morning.
Thank you so much.
Cue the applause sound effect.
thank you so much. Thank you. Terrific panel. And again, I'll remind you that this is the Channel 3 focused on investment and technology. If you're looking for pre-K, that's Channel 1. If you're looking for K-12, that's Channel 2. You can go to the chat. You can see the link to get connected. But now it's my privilege to host our second and final panel. And again, I'll remind you that after this panel on Channel 1, we have Mark Brackett and coping with COVID, which will be immediately following this panel, and you can get the link to do it. But this should be a fun panel. I'm very much looking forward to this and getting insights from our panelists. I'm going to make a quick introduction of who we have, and then what we'll do is I'm going to give each of you an opportunity to talk about quickly what your background is, what you're doing. But first, I want to introduce Alexis Horowitz Burdick, who is the head of LEGO Ventures. She's an entrepreneur who sold her e-commerce company to LVMH, who's based in Singapore. Again, fabulous background. She's got true street creds where she dropped out of college, became a ski bum, and has a great history to where she is today. Secondly, we have Mercedes Bent, who's a partner at Lightspeed. Has to be one of the great names, not only in venture capital, but just the world. I wish I had that cooler name, but Mercedes' background, grew up an inventor family. Out of college, she was a consultant in the AR/VR space, and then worked at Harvard and All Ventures. Now, as I said, the consumer group at Lightspeed. We have Ryan Craig, who is the founder of Lightspeed. Oh my gosh. No, he's not the founder of Lightspeed. He's the founder of University Ventures. Ryan's a longtime friend of mine and of GSV. And prior to GSV, Ryan's a lawyer. He's an entrepreneur. He's an author. And he's a great investor. He founded Wellspring. And prior to University Ventures, he was at Warburg Pincus. And many of you have seen the great books and articles that he's written. And then lastly, Rob Hutter, who is the founder of Learn Capital, who was the moderator of the previous panel, which again, I thought was tremendous. Rob, again, has amazing experience as an entrepreneur, founded a number of companies as an investor in many leading companies in the edtech space. And again, I think it's gonna be a fascinating conversation really about what it means. We call before the crisis, we call it BC, before Corona. Now, the period that we're in now, we call it AD, after disease, and what that means. I'm gonna turn it over to each panelist just to give a quick a further bio, kind of minute or so, and then we'll get into the questions, okay? So maybe we could start with Alexis.
Thanks so much, Michael. I hope that everybody is staying healthy and well, and definitely wishing Deb a speedy recovery as well. LEGO Ventures. It's a really exciting effort by, the world's biggest toy company to really think about what the future of play is going to look like. And certainly, I'm sure, as we'll talk about right now, that is accelerating, obviously, on the educational front, but as well as on the consumer front. And I think that, you know, it's an incredibly exciting time for us to see what can be adopted and what can be normalized in both spaces. But we really think about, you know, the intersection of creativity, learning, and play. We look for entrepreneurs who are trying to think about how to bring systematic play to kids, whether that be through educational channels or consumer channels or anything else that we can dream of, social networks. We're really not limited by the concept, but more that it adheres to the sort of truth of the Lego idea, which is really this open-ended creativity. You know, allowing kids to explore and learn and create mastery and really just be endlessly creative, right? And so that's where we look for entrepreneurs and you know, really excited in terms of what we've seen since we launched just a few years ago.
Great. Mercedes.
Hi, I'm Mercedes Bent. Yes, my parents really did name me that, and I love it. Every single time I get to say that. And yeah, my background, well, Lightspeed, first who we are, we're a pretty large venture capital firm. We are investing out of about $10 billion right now across all of our geographies, which include India, China, US, Middle East, and Europe. I'm on the early stage consumer team and focused now almost entirely on ed tech and future of work, also focus on consumer and fintech a bit. Our our ed tech / future of work investments include Handshake, Byju's, Clever, FlockJ. I know I'm forgetting a couple of others as well, Eightfold and White Hat and BetterUp.
Thank you. Ryan.
Great. Hello. I'm here at the Manchester Grand Hyatt. Where is everyone? Something going on?
Room 3201. Where are you?
Okay. It's good to see. Good to see your face, Mike and Rob and Alexis Mercedes. Thank you. University Ventures. If you're not aware, we're a private equity firm. We initially focused pretty much head on to the higher ed space. Made a number of investments in kind of early OPMs, tech platforms in higher ed. And about 5 years ago, we began to focus increasingly at the intersection of education and employment. And we write a lot about that. And we were fortunate enough to be able to put our money where our mouth is. And so we've been focused the last few years on establishing new pathways to work that may or may not involve traditional universities, but across skill gap sectors in tech and healthcare. And so that's what we're focusing on. You can think of it like a new form of apprenticeship model, but one where there's less friction, both for the candidate and for the employer. And my book that you see behind me is Faster and Cheaper Pathways, Faster and Cheaper Alternatives to College. That's what we're focused on, faster and cheaper pathways to good first jobs.
Quit hawking your book. Rob.
Awesome. That's great. Mike, thank you again for having me. And what a great panel. And great to see folks. Ryan, and congrats on the book, the new book, and a series of great thought pieces. Alexis, good seeing you. And Mercedes, hello. Learn Capital has been doing ed tech for about 10 years. I was talking to the earlier panel, you know, back when it started, it was a 1% digitally penetrated segment, you know, rising to a whopping 3% as of our 19 tabulations. And obviously what's really interesting about right now is that is it going from 3, you know, post-COVID to 30, 40, 50? I mean, unlike e-commerce, you know, we don't need warehouses or logistics or, you know, yeah, automated supply routes and so forth. We can actually just do what we're doing, we believe, by more of this type of technology. So we're super enthusiastic about this. And you know, our focus is, you know, similar to other folks on this panel, looking at what's new, what's innovative. If there's any sort of distinct theme behind Learn Capital's interest, we kind of like to, you know, if you will, throw the ball along and kind of find opportunities that have, you know, sort of the, you know, the cliched transformative impact. But we'll take those bets, you know, more frequently than others in terms of opportunities that still have, I think, tremendous durable value, but different types of risk reward ratios. So in that regard, maybe similar to classic VC trying to do this in ed tech space, which I thought for many people was probably an impossible dream. Even for us, when we really started out, it was like, wow, this is taken a while for this surf to kind of pick up in the last 5 years, as all of us on this panel know, and know, and Mike, the companies we're involved with, what a 5 years it's been. So now we say, what a 5 years it's going to be, is kind of my impulse. And you know, honestly, you know, one last intro comment I'll make, I don't know how other people feel about this, we chat about this in our partnership on our Zooms, is, you know, it's one thing to think about all the companies we're currently involved in and the acceleration that might exist. It's another thing to think about the creativity that is going to blossom in the edtech entrepreneurial community in the upcoming quarters, as people wake up, think about what they just went through, and create bold new visions for companies that are, to some degree, completely unimaginable from where we sit today. So that's what I'm really excited about.
And Rob, that's great. And that's what I hope we can cover in the next 40 minutes or so that we have with this panel, because I like you, think that what's super exciting is basically as a starting gun went off. I mean, we've had this shift that's been going on for 20 years, which has been tremendous. But this this new world that we're entering, I think, is quite exciting as it relates to the creativity and the entrepreneurs that are going to come here with breathtaking ideas. I just want to first get your perspective.